the races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, 15 into hour two, recapping the weekend. Just joined Michael McCarthy and Mark Cassie, two of the great ones out of the Keeneland weekend. Joe Bianca joining me from TDN. Get some opinions from Joe, what he thought resonated, and plus looking forward to Saratoga. Going to be an unusual form of Saratoga, obviously, and still waiting, hopefully, for some word from health officials and from Albany in terms of the plans that NYRA submitted. And, you know, they're in constant communication with the hopes of first getting some owners to be able to come to the racetrack, both in the mornings and the afternoons. And, you know, depending on how things turn as the summer continues, you know, the hope continues to be that perhaps, you know, some attendance might be possible. Feels a little less likely than it was, you know, a month ago. Joe, good morning.
Morning, Steve. Good to be on.
Joe, last week I slipped in. Andy actually was available on the Monday, so and wasn't going to be available Tuesday, so we kind of skipped over. I've been alternating with you and Meg on Mondays, and some thoughts about this Keeneland 5 days. I've got sort of an unpopular suggestion about it is a little after the fact, but I'll get to that. And then, of course, you know, we got through a Belmont season that, you know, was really strong. I mean, particularly the Saturdays. But some thoughts about this transitional point we're at on the summer calendar.
Well, it was super interesting to see Keeneland in July. It was like, I don't know, it was kind of surreal. I guess the whole year has been surreal and will continue to be. The track records were falling left and right, so that's something that I think people are going to, you know, have an asterisk about in their mind, kind of like the Triple Crown this year. But, you know, it was great that they were able to pull it off. You know, kudos to Keeneland and kudos to all the Kentucky, you know, horse racing minds that were able to pull this thing off. 5 days, really jam-packed racing. Saturday, I thought, you know, I thought that was one of the best cards you're going to see all year, with those six consecutive graded stakes and just, you know, great field, a lot of storylines. You know, I would start obviously with Art Collector in the Bluegrass and Swiss Skydiver. I thought they were just, you know, really, really, really good and lived up to the hype, both of them. Guarana battling back to take the Madison. I thought, you know, she's shown a lot of talent so far in her career, but to show that kind of, those kind of guts after being passed by a multiple grade one winner, I thought that was super impressive. Gave Chad Brown his 100th grade one win. A couple other interesting performances, Speech upsetting Venetian Harbor. But, you know, overall, it was a sorely missed in April when Keeneland was gone. And I got to give a lot of credit to Keeneland that they really pulled the plug early on their sale and their meet in April, and they weren't screwing around. They listened to the experts and the doctors and scientists, and they weren't going to try to like squeeze in anything while this was going on. So it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal racing. You know, it was only 5 days, but it was hard to be mad at seeing Keeneland, you know, at some point before the fall meet.
It's after the fact, and it's easy to say now. And I think with so many people excited, you know, and just happy to have the kind of standards that you know, a Keeneland spring season includes, you know, that drove everybody's, you know, pleasure at you know, being able to, you know, to watch and bet and participate in the 5 days. I will say that this situation regarding the jocks and the, you know, the moving around to stay with respective stake horses, that part of it might have been a little, and I understand that people weren't necessarily thinking along those lines, but that part of it was a little bit of an invitation for trouble.
And, yeah, and I'm with you on that. And you saw yesterday that Flavian Pratt tested positive.
Right.
It seems like the epicenter of that was at Los Alamitos, and all these guys went to Los Alamitos for that Los Al Derby card, and suddenly they're testing positive left and right. But yeah, it's not a good idea to have jockeys flying across the country, going to different tracks and different jocks rooms, especially like while this thing is surging again. It's just, I get it. I get these jockeys don't want to lose these mounts, but I feel like some kind of deal could be worked out, you know, with the trainers or the owners, that you give up the mount for a race or two and you get the horse back. But, you know, one of the one track that was really running throughout the earlier peak was Oaklawn, and it seemed like they had really good protocols in place. They separated the out-of-town jockeys from the local jockeys, and they didn't seem to have any problems. And now all of a sudden, I don't know whether these tracks aren't quite as, you know, or they're a little more lax with the protocols, and you know, the jockeys are mingling a little bit more, but it definitely looks bad to have these jockeys flying all across the country, and then we have four major top-flight jockeys testing positive. It's just, we got to do better than that.
Yeah, and I've got feelers out to Johnny Velasquez, hoping Johnny joins us in hour three to discuss it. You know, I know exactly what has transpired, at least in New York, with the preparations to come to Saratoga, and you know, that is was a comprehensive testing of every single person that was on the list. You know, the NYRA management had every barn submit the list of who is coming to Saratoga, and then every one of them had to be tested, and then they were informed 700 tests, and then the last couple of days at the Belmont Cafe, they could come and get a clearance that was put on their NYRA badge, so that only people. I mean, I went yesterday, Joe, to do TV with Seth Merrow, and we all had to have, you know, the latest test. I mean, I've already had, you know, COVID and have got antibodies, but I still had to go and get a fresh test to get, you know, a clearance. And that same thing's going to be true of any, you know, media that is involved and any support staff. I mean, they're doing their best.
Yeah. We've gotten the same word from the people at Saratoga, and I think they're trying to do the best they can. I was a little wary when they first announced that they were still going to run at Saratoga. I was of the mind that it was better just to keep the population at Belmont where things were under control and not, you know, ship everybody upstate, you know, what I felt was unnecessarily. But, you know, they're going to go through with it. They're going to do the best that they can, and hopefully the thing can be managed. But, you know, it is scary. It is scary to move an entire population to a community that really hasn't been struck by this in the same way that the community downstate has. So I have a hard time seeing it going off without a hitch, but I know NYRA has done all the right things throughout this whole process. So I think they're definitely going to do their best. And you know, we obviously, all of us in racing, hope that things can be contained up there, because we'd love to see a full on Saratoga meet. Don't want to see anything like what's going on in Lone Star now, where they had to, you know, cancel racing because a couple of people have tested positive and it's starting a mini spread. So, you know, fingers crossed for Thursday and beyond.
Well, and we'll talk about the meet in a second. Some other elements of the weekend and really the last couple of weeks. Where's your 3-year-old vision right now? What are you? We're 2 weeks removed from Tis the Law's performance, and you know, Baffert seems to be, you know, kind of working his group toward, you know, their, you know, last assignments. Authentic goes on Saturday. Uncle Chuck with a, you know, with a competent win in the Los Al Derby. He needs to step forward a little further. It looks like he's going to. It looks like he's going to have Cezanne participate in the Shared Belief. And then, of course, you had Art Collector. I thought, you know, step forward really brilliantly. In fact, Tom Drury is going to join us when we're done, Joe. But what's your 3-year-old dance card look like?
Well, I mean, earlier in the year, I thought there was a big four, and three of them are gone now. So I thought it was Tiz the Law, Charlatan, Nadal, and Maxfield. So Tiz the Law kind of won the war of attrition in that way, but, you know, it's hard to take anything away from anything he's done. Obviously, was brilliant in the Belmont and had a couple of great races at Gulfstream as well. And, you know, I think he's the clear class of the group right now. And below that, you know, I think there's a big mishmash of horses below him. I think you could put Honor AP in that number two spot right now. I believe that he was the second choice among individual betting interests in the last Derby pool. Authentic's up there as well. Art Collector, I think, you know, was a little bit under the radar. He's a really interesting horse. You know, he started his career on turf. He had that Levamisole positive for Joe Sharp, switched Barnes, switched to the dirt, and really has just taken off since then. So I would put him in that second tier as well. Authentic and Uncle Chuck seem to be the leaders for Bob Baffert, but we'll see what Cezanne does. But I just think at this point, still, you have Tiz the Law, and then below that, you have a real mix of horses, who any of whom could jump up and challenge for that top spot. Because as great and as brilliant as Tiz the Law has looked so far, it's not like he's running 110 buyers and he's just so much faster on paper than all these horses.
Right.
He's been better than who he's faced so far. So got to put him in the number one spot right now. But beneath that, I think there's plenty of opportunity for challengers.
Well, there is going to now with the Bluegrass and the Indiana Derby behind us, it leaves us with actually a much more manageable, for whatever reason, this list looked of three-year-old preps, it looked, you know, more unwieldy than it does now. Peter Pan coming up on Thursday, Haskell on Saturday, Shared Belief then on August 1st, and Travers on the 8th, Ellis Park Derby the 9th. Monmouth is going to run that Pegasus, which becomes essentially the Lexington of New Jersey, with a 20 points, 8, 4, and 2, kind of the last
round. Yeah, last call now.
Yeah. Yeah, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 left and 200-point races. 350-point races, 120-point race. So there will be a couple more leapfrogs that turn up on your list. But it does feel like now we can sort of begin to focus in a little bit more. And that, you know, that Peter Pan, how much of Thursday did you look at?
I skimmed the field of the two stakes. I didn't really dive in too deeply into it, but yeah, it does look like there's a couple of interesting fringe contenders in there. Another weird thing to see the Peter Pan run at Saratoga. I'm like never going to get used to these kind of things, but yeah, it's definitely cool to have a big three-year-old race early in the meet at the Spa. I wish it would replace the Curlin Stakes, which I hate. It's like my least favorite stake in the country when they run the Curlin Stakes and the Jim Dandy on the same weekend. It'll be good to see the 3-year-olds going two turns at Saratoga.
Well, and we just talked to Mark Cassie, who's involved quite a bit in the. In the Schuylerville, and I actually had not looked really at the Schuylerville. Glancing now, Make Mischief down inside the New York Bred for Gary Barber, and Wesley Ward, who has gotten ridiculously hot. You know, it's so funny when there was a point where, you know, one of the storylines early in the 2-year-old season was, you know, that the Wesley Wards weren't running that great. And, you know, then all of a sudden we get to Royal Ascot and Wesley has, two terrific performances, and it seems to have lifted and elevated the entire barn. And what's amazing is it's one thing if one division, when you have an operation and you've got multiple divisions, it's one thing when one division gets hot and horses are starting to run well, but Wesley's horses are running well everywhere all of a sudden. It's been a real turnaround. And Cassie actually, has the same MO right now. He was kind of, a little bit asleep at the wheel, the barns, and they've all come alive.
It's an interesting thing with Wesley because I always felt like, part of his success at Keeneland in April was, he's so good and so much better than everybody else at getting these horses to be cranked so early in their two-year-old year. And I think, honestly, it's kind of been to his detriment a little bit because most of these horses don't really go on to do much in their three, four-year-old years. So I think there's some debate to be had about the wisdom of that. But it's interesting to see the two-year-old year delayed, the start of the two-year-old year really delayed into May, June, July, and now he's really rolling, whereas I think before he had a developmental advantage with his two-year-old. But now I don't think that that's necessarily the case. He's got the right horses, and he's got them ready to rock. A couple interesting horses in the Schuylerville that I believe have been private purchases, that Queen Arella, the Spitzer horse, for Jay Stables and Reeves Thoroughbred Racing, and then Hopeful Princess, who was a private purchase by Stone Street and has switched over to Asmussen. So that's always an interesting thing early in the two-year-old years when you see these two-year-olds switch hands privately and see if they can replicate that past form. But definitely a lot of interesting horses coming from a lot of different directions in that race.
And then the Peter Pan, a quick rundown for those of you that haven't. The opening day card is terrific on Thursday. Mohawk for Rudy Brissett, and this, of course, an Uncle Mo that started. This is the Uncle Mo out of Princess Arabella that was bred by Jane Lyon, and a $925,000 Keeneland yearling, and the SF and Starlight and et cetera et al. Transferred Mohawk to Rudy Brissett, and coming off of an allowance win on the grass, actually, kind of a tightener, I suppose, and first time around two turns. So Mohawk showing up here, kind of interesting, and gets Joel Rosario to further add to the intrigue. And Paul Pompa with Country Grammar, the tonalist colt. The broken
misspelled Country Grammar.
A good point. I don't know if that was intentional, but I'll check with Paul. And this actually, our friends Scott and Debbie Pierce, they bred this colt, and quite nice. Modernist entered here, but there still is a chance that Rat Ortiz, by the way, gets back aboard Country Grammar after breaking the maiden together. And then Modernist, but apparently Mott may also cross-enter in the Haskell. So we'll see Wednesday what happens there. Ray Handel, the very hot Ray Handel, Celtic striker, coming off that crazy win in the Easy Goer. Candy Tycoon for Todd, and Mathis Stables. The Twirling Candy Colt behind Rushy in that Oaklawn allowance on Arkansas Derby Day. Mystic Guide for Mike Stidham, also being considered for the Haskell. So there might be two cross entrants. You've got Gustavo Delgado showing up with Caracaro. This one an Uncle Mo colt that broke the maiden last time when seen in January. It's been working steadily at Calder. Chestertown, the $2 million Tappet New York bred for the Bromans. And West Point, going to get another graded stake try in here. And then Cazzarelli for Amos. And I don't put anything past Amos. Here's a horse that ran for 50 and broke the maiden for 30, and he's going to try to duplicate his Ohio Derby success. And I don't know, if he's another Dean Martini, but he'll be the longest shot on the board.
What I'm really interested in is Caracaro. You mentioned him. This is a horse who I think a lot of people have been wondering where he's been. He had a good second in his debut and then ran away to a six-length win, breaking his maiden January 11th at Gulfstream, and just hasn't been seen since then. He's a TDM right. Rising Star, but seems to have been working pretty well. To go 111-3 for six furlongs at over that Gulfstream West Calder racetrack is moving. And I like when the trainers ship in and they get that little tightener over the track. He worked three furlongs the other day, or yesterday morning at Saratoga. So I was like, when they get that little bit of a feel for the track before they run again. But yeah, he's a really interesting horse, and he's got the biggest buyer in the field. He ran a 92 when he broke his maiden, so he's the one I think I'll be most interested in. But there is a lot to go on in this field.
Should also mention Joe Haskell, and given the TDN proximity to Monmouth, what are you taking anything in? What's your coverage schedule for the summer?
I mean, we're not going to have too much on site reporting. It's just the nature of the beast at the moment. We might have one or two people up at Saratoga, but it won't be the usual, eight-week complement of reporting at Saratoga. We might have somebody at the Monmouth. I'm not 100% aware what the schedule is for that. We usually have someone out there at the track, and I know they are allowing some fans at Monmouth and media, so I assume we'll have somebody reporting from there. It's obviously a great day of racing, and Monmouth is the home track. So we always root for them to do well. I think it's really interesting at Monmouth to see how it goes this year without Service and Navarro there. That was like one of the things that I thought about when those indictments first came down, is that the track that, I think was most dominated by those two guys was Monmouth. And it was just hard for anybody else to really make a dent in the trainer standings, because those two guys were just, they would win everything, and it led to a lot of bad racing, in my opinion. It led to a lot of 5 and 6 horse fields, a lot of short favorites, and a lot of really just unbettable cards, frankly. And that's going to be interesting to see how the trainer standings shake out this year at Monmouth, because you don't have those two guys at the top dominating everything artificially. So that's something I'm interested to see at Monmouth. But yeah, we're glad to see them run in. We're glad to see at least some fans in the building. I hope, everybody's doing the right things. I know Bill Finley had a story last week or last weekend about Monmouth. He went out there to see what was what. And I think he said a lot of people weren't wearing masks, which, drives me up the wall. You've seen my podcast rant about it. But, hopefully things work out. We are in a much better position now in New York and New Jersey. And, overall, we're glad to see Monmouth back running again and look forward to the Haskell.
Well, and they again ran the Friday, sort of the Friday evening appetizer to the two weekend cards, and I talked to Dennis Drazen on Friday. They're doing nice business, off to a good start on that front, and it is one of the most delightful places, particularly under the summer backdrop. It's one of the most wonderful places, and people hear me gush about Monmouth all the time. It was the first, it was really the first, even though I grew up, in and around New York, it was really the first racetrack that I could attend, like, on a regular basis. I mean, that I lived, I lived 20 minutes away from, give or take, in Brielle, and, could buzz over there to catch, three, four races at the end of the day or whatever, and I couldn't figure out a way to make money around Julie Crone, because if you bet with her, you couldn't make anything, and if you bet against her, you'd lose. So it was a no-win proposition.
Now,
how about the two wins? There you go. You can, after years of disappointment, you can make up with Farron Peterson, who won her first two races. Very, very excited for them. And Julie was on with me a couple of weeks ago in advance of the meet, actually. And, she just raved about Peterson, and, she's got what it takes. So pretty cool.
Yeah, I just got a second what you said about Monmouth. That was one of the first tracks that I went to as well. And if you haven't been to Monmouth and you're ever in the area during the summer, you should definitely, try to take a trip down there. I always love walking out of there with the summer wind by Frank Sinatra playing over the loudspeakers. It's just, It's really cool, and they do a lot of great stuff in terms of, you know, events and, like, tastings and food trucks and all that stuff. So it's I would describe it as quiet but loud. I think it's quiet because it's, you know, it's a small beachside community, but it gets pretty rowdy on there on a Saturday, and it's just it's always a lot of fun. One of those racetracks that I think, in a similar way to Saratoga, not quite the same, but is kind of frozen in time.
Yeah,
and
very much.
Something I've always appreciated about Monmouth.
Well, and it's the thing that is, and this isn't unusual, you know, that it, we describe it very frequently as a family, and as a, you know, as a generational facility. And you know, there's plenty of places where, you know, there's families that, you know, have worked, you know, generations of families have worked, but not necessarily as long as Monmouth has been around. And there literally is, I mean, parents, grandparents, you know, that have worked at whatever it is. I mean, as ushers and red caps or ticket punch personnel, you know, mutuals, whatever it is, there's just been this, you know, historic generational tie to Monmouth. And that's one of the reasons it's been so much fun to follow Mrs. De Tomaso and her sister Hope Jones as daughters of Amory Haskell. And their, you know, their success, it's just special.
It's definitely a track that I think, you know, attracts a lot of casual fans. I don't think there are that many tracks like that left in America. I would say maybe Saratoga, Del Mar. Monmouth is definitely in that handful of tracks where, you know, people who don't know that much about racing go there because it's a summer event in New Jersey. And I, you know, I'm not going to the office these days and working from home, but back when I was, you know, taking that New Jersey Transit down during the summer to head into the office, there were just so many people with coolers and, you know, backpacks and all this, just going down to Monmouth to spend the day. And you can tell that they weren't, you know, most of them weren't diehard racing fans. It was one of the Jersey Shore things you have to do during the summer. And for that reason alone, like, it's good to see it still standing and still working its way through everything.
Well, and speaking of which, for those I didn't say this yet. I did it on TV yesterday with Seth. Dr. Post and Authentic headlining the Haskell Field. Ancient Warrior, Ete Indien, Fame to Famous, Jesus' Team, Lebda, New York Traffic, and Sonneman. And then I mentioned Modernist and Mystic Guide are under consideration. They've entered the Peter Pan, but they might show up in the Haskell entry box as well. And while we're on the topic of big races and touching on a few different topics, Joe, that we hit, they also are head at Del Mar for Saturday with the San Diego and the return of Maximum Security, and with the Luis Saez sidelined, Abel Cedillo. A very able replacement. Abel Cedillo is going to ride Maximum Security, and that field ended up with Higher Power, and Custer Ronis and company are going to have to replace Flavian, Axeman for Baffert, Midcourt for Sheriffs with J.J. Hernandez, Umberto Rispoli on Dark Vader for Peter Urton, then Maximum Security. Combatant is back there again, of course, for Costa, and Drayden Van Dyke gets back aboard, was with him in the San Pascal, and Sharp Samurai, Mark Glatt, with Edwin Maldonado. So, nice field of seven for the San Diego, leading toward the Pacific Classic.
To that point we were talking about before, about the jockeys, you know, flipping all around the country, they already have an agreement with Luis Saez that once he's back healthy and able to ride again, he can ride Maximum Security. So I think in general, jockeys should, and the agents should be able to, like, let one go every once in a while and not get their clients sick by having the jockeys jet all around the country. But yeah, you know, it's an interesting race, but I think, you know, Maximum Security on form obviously lays over the field, but also there's not a ton of speed in there. I think the only other real speed horse is Axeman, who's another Bob Baffert horse, so I'm guessing he's not going to be hard sent to duel with Maximum Security. So, you know, if he's anything like his previous form, you got to think he's gonna cruise in there. But it's an interesting thing when these other trainers take over these former Jason Service horses, because they're kind of like in a no-win situation. Because, you know, if the horse runs as well as they did before, people are gonna say, oh, so he's juicing the horse too. And then if the horse doesn't run as well as they did before, it's gonna be like, oh man, what an incompetent move that he couldn't get this horse to run his top races again. But you know, you got to think he's gonna still be at least close to what he was before. He's been working well at Santa Anita and had a 5-furlong work at Del Mar over the weekend that looked pretty sharp. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he's the king of the mountain right now in the handicap division, but I would hear footsteps of Tom Zeta if I were them, and I think you got to run in a couple of really big races and try to win some big races with Maximum Security if you want to win that title.
Agreed, and just, you know, whether he's a, you know, whether he's a point of contention and consternation or not, he's a talent, and it's good to get, you know, it's good to get him back out and mixing it up. In the meantime, I keep saying, even with Tom's Detat and him and a few others, it's the distaff division, Joe, that is really percolating right now. Mm-hmm. And you start folding in these emergent 3-year-old fillies, and that distaff is going to be a real showcase come Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, it's going to be a total war. And, you know, I think the matchup that everybody is waiting for is to see Monomoy Girl and Midnight Bizou clash again. It's really cool that they're both still running as 5-year-olds. And, you know, Monomoy Girl, I think, you know, she hasn't been brilliant in her two races back, but I think she's been pretty damn good considering how long she was off. I think she's still, you know, top flight filly. Midnight Bizou didn't get a great figure in the Florida League, but one as easy as can be. Hopefully we can get to see them before the distaff, because there's been talk that Midnight Bizou might run in the Classic instead. She's already run against boys once in the Saudi Cup, so maybe we can see them clash at the Personal Ensign or the Spinster or something like that before the Breeders' Cup, because I don't know that it's guaranteed that they're going to see each other at Keeneland in November. But, yeah, you're right. It's a good point about the 3-year-old fillies, too, because this seems to be a real bumper crop. A 3-year-old fillies with Swiss Skydiver and Gamin, Speech now ran a big buyer and winning the Ashland. I'm not sure where Donna Veloce is, but she's super talented, obviously, as well. This is a real good class of 3-year-old fillies. And, even if Midnight Bizou and Monomoy Girl still do their thing, they might have their hands full by the time these horses develop into late-season 3-year-olds in the fall.
Joe Bianca from the TDN, and it's a big TDN week, not just with the racing coverage, but we've got the sale as well tomorrow and Wednesday and Thursday, and an opportunity, opportunity under gavel to distribute 2-year-olds. Certainly going to be notable here, and I think there's plenty of people out there that are looking to fill their orders, and should be a good 3 days of horse sale.
Yeah, it's good to see the sale calendar back kicking again. You know, the 2-year-old sales just wrapped up. Horses are racing age. I think there's going to be a pretty big cohort of people who are going to be trying to move horses. So we'll see how that goes. Yearling sales have consolidated a bit now into September, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes and how that market is. I think, you know, I'm not the biggest expert. You could talk to somebody else on the staff for that, but I think it was a little tricky at the OBS spring sale, delayed to June, but I think that Facing Mid-Atlantic had slightly better returns than most people thought, so hopefully that market's starting to rebound a little bit, because I know there's a lot of people that, you know, were hurting earlier in the year and not able to move horses and replenish and all that. And it gums up the works for everybody behind the scenes in racing. So hopefully this summer and into the fall we can get that back on schedule.
Great to get Joe Bianca back on schedule. And Joe, we'll look forward to Saratoga. Maybe get you on a couple of Fridays, maybe some opinions.
Absolutely, man. I'll be around. Talk to me.
You bet. Joe Bianca, everybody. Jay Bianca, TDN, Joe. And, of course, he's got the Writer's Room podcast. Who's on this week?
We're going to try to have your boy Tom Drury, so send him my way after you talk to him.
He's on right now. He's on the other line. I'll do an introduction. I'll tell Tommy, who's listening in, this is Joe Bianca from TDN, Tommy, and he's going to reach you later today and have you on the TDN Writers Room podcast, all right? So there you go, Joe.
You should be my agent.
Please. Mentor is enough. I got my hands full with you for years. Joe Bianca, everybody. And the real bright light at TDN. We're going to stay right here because a conversation that really have been looking forward to since Saturday, kind of anticipated that Art Collector was the horse to beat in the bluegrass. And it's a horse of a career for Tommy Drury, his first graded stake win, and it comes in a race, I imagine, Tommy, that was as coveted growing up around the game as any that you could have hoped to win. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Tommy, just talk about the whole feeling, going into Saturday and the whole experience.
You know, it was, I'll be honest, it was kind of a blur. We run enough horses that, I kept telling my assistants all week, we're just going to approach this just like we would any other race. We're not going to do anything different. So I guess, from the morning to the time that the horse left the barn to go to the paddock, it was just kind of cruise control. And, once you leave that holding barn at Keeneland, though, and you actually head to the paddock, there were some butterflies. There were some, you think about what race you're in and, what horses have won that race over the years and the people involved in it. And it was a big deal. It was exciting. It was a little emotional. It was just a big deal. So just to get that far, I think that was an accomplishment within itself. And gosh, to have him run the way he did, I still haven't found the words to describe it.
The horse himself, and we can almost back this up a little bit, and the opportunity that was afforded by Bruce Lunsford to send you the horse, and you got to get to know him. We talked about this after the big allowance win in anticipation of running in the stakes and trying to angle toward Derby. Tommy, I said on Saturday night and I said earlier in the show today, this is so encouraging for horsemen of really any size, because all anybody ever wants is the opportunity with a horse like this. And talk about Bruce, reaching out to you and sending him your way.
Bruce he's just been a longtime supporter. We've had a lot of good horses for Bruce over the years. I guess Madcap Escapade, having her as a 2-year-old, that was probably, that was really the first good horse I think that ever went through my barn. She went on to win the Ashland and was a grade one winner. And, to be lucky enough for Bruce to keep having us back and to keep letting us work with his horses. And, not only in the background, but, Bruce will leave a horse or two for me to race. And, he's given us some really good opportunities and some allowance races. And, we've won a few races over at Keeneland and Churchill together. And, for me, that's a big opportunity. So, to be sitting here in this situation, it's just unbelievable. I'm very grateful and appreciative of the opportunity that Bruce has given me. And, I think we're certainly capable of doing the job, I think there's a lot of horsemen out there that would be capable of handling this. Again, you hit the nail on the head. It's all about the opportunity. And, I'm just really thankful that Bruce was kind enough to give me one.
When you get a horse that is not necessarily mid-career, I mean, it's still fairly early in his career, talk about the evaluation process and what the expectations were, how Bruce even introduced him to you as maybe he and Joe had been talking about and what the thoughts were about how far he could go.
you know, Bruce didn't really say a whole lot. He just kind of, you know, he sent us the horse and, you know, he allowed us to do our evaluation of him. You know, if there was any one thing that I think might have given me a little edge, it was Brian. You know, Brian had ridden this horse last summer and fall, and, you know, he knew the horse well. And once we were able to, you know, once he got back from New Orleans and we were able to get him to come out to the training center and jump on him and breathe him a time or two for us, he was really able to tell me, you know, we were able to have a discussion, you know, what's different from, you know, this year from last year. You know, is this horse jump forward from 2 to 3? Where, you know, what do you think? And I think that, you know, that probably helped me, you know, helped us to evaluate him and helped me to know exactly where I was at with the horse.
Explain to people too that when, you know, when you get a horse like this and you know how you introduce him to your program and what you're watching for in terms of his, you know, his introduction. And, you know, horses do not like to have their ambient surroundings change. They, you know, they're going to have to deal with a new you know, with a whole new, probably in some cases, a feeding program and a training regimen, and you might send horses out at a different time than Joe does, that kind of thing. I mean, talk about, you know, what issues crop up too, Tommy, when you're in that setting.
You know, it was this horse, you know, a lot of horses, everything that you've just said, a lot of horses can struggle with every one of those individual things, whether it's a different feed program, different set of people around them, riders, grooms, you know, whatnot. You know, some of these horses, that does have an effect on them. Fortunately, our collector, he's just so push button. He's so classy. He's so easy. He just falls into whatever routine you put him in. You know, I've had him here at Skylight. I've had him at Churchill. And, you know, he's the same horse. He takes the surface with him. He takes that same mentality with him. He, you know, when he trains here at Skylight, he comes out and, you know, he may stand there with his ears pricked for 20 minutes before, you know, before we ever ask him to jog off. He's the same exact horse at Churchill Downs, you know, with a lot more traffic and a lot more excitement going on. So with him, it, you know, he's made my job easy. You know, he didn't turn a hair when I saddled him Saturday. He was calm, cool, and collected. He was definitely handling it better than the trainer was. So there's no question about that. But, you know, that's really just helped us as much as anything is he's just such a classy individual and easy and kind about whatever you're doing with him.
Well, all that's gone on with him is strength to strength. The 103 buyer in here that really, you know, makes it very clear that he's as fast and as elite as any of the three-year-olds that are headed toward Derby. When it came to the approach in here, you know, what were your thoughts going in about pace and you know, knowing that the filly was probably going to be, you know, at least prominent early? Anything about the, you know, about how Brian was going to approach this going in? What were the thoughts?
You know, we chatted a little bit about, you know, a couple of different scenarios that could happen, but at the end of the day, I left it up to Brian. You know, I have complete faith in his judgment. He, you know, he knows this horse like the back of his hand. He's worked him. He's ridden him in races. He knows exactly what he's capable of doing. And you know, I think in a race like that, you got a 13 horse field. You're not sure what everybody's doing. You suspect how the thing's going to set up, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. So, I completely left it up to him, and I don't think, you know, I mean, the guy rode him absolutely perfect. I don't think anybody in the country could have ridden that horse any better than Brian did on Saturday.
How did he, it's only 48 hours, but how did he look yesterday morning, and how did he look today?
You know, it seems good. You know, he that's the first time this year that he's had to really work for it, and you know, again, it's like he just keeps checking the boxes off. We came out of the allowance race in good order, and he trained up to the bluegrass well. But, you know, he hadn't competed against Stakes Company. We knew that there wasn't going to be any 24, 48s in the bluegrass. We knew that, you know, it was going to be a racehorse time, and we knew that we were going to have to be a racehorse to win it. And, you know, when they hooked up at the 316th pole, it's, you know, it's like, okay, we're, you know, we're going to find out what we got right here and now. And, you know, this little guy just kept coming. I mean, he, you know, and you sure, you know, you can't take anything away from that filly that Kenny ran. And I told everybody that would listen to me before the race that, I just didn't think that Kenny would be running her in that spot if she wasn't absolutely training through the bridle. And, you know, I think she ran that kind of race. You know, that filly ran a winning race, and, you know, fortunately we were just a little bit better than her. But, you know, in my opinion, those two kind of separated themselves out from the rest of the field.
Very much so. And, you know, even with some trouble behind, we just talked to Mark Cassie, and, you know, Mark talked about Enforceable having, you know, some traffic here and there and some issues to deal with. But it was pretty clear. I mean, the two of you, seven clear of Rushy and Art Collector. I mean, it really, to me, what was impressive was, you know, how he just powered away from the filly. I mean, he had to kind of churn to get to her. And then a couple of strides later, you know, he just, you know, moved away. And, you know, Bernardini out of a distorted humor mare, and it looked like the mile in the eighth was, you know, just when he was really getting into gear. So, you know, that next eighth of a mile clearly going to be fine for him looking ahead to September.
I think so. I, you know, as a trainer, you're always kind of watching little things. And, you know, I noticed again, you know, galloping out, he kind of had his ears thrown up. And, you know, it wasn't like he got to the wire and was just like, okay, I'm done, and ears flat on his head and just immediately pulled up. You know, he kind of galloped out on around the turn, had his ears thrown up, and, you know, just looked like a horse that was just happy doing his thing. And at this point, I would certainly suspect that a mile and a quarter would be, you know, within his range. You never know for sure until you do it. But I think Brian said it best after the race. They're all 3-year-olds, and they're all trying to do the same thing. So, you know, you just got to train your horse to the best of your ability and lead him over there and take your best shot with him.
Well, and that's what's been going on. Before we talk a couple of other topics and you know, your own experiences around the game, Tommy, what's the game plan going forward with him between now and September?
You know, it's funny. I don't have a game plan right now. I just want to get back on him. I want to make sure that he's come out of the race okay. You know, there's a lot of things that you want to take into consideration. You know, this is going to be August, not May, that you're trying to get ready. You know, what's the weather going to be like? You know, ideally, best case scenario, you'd like to just train up and take your best shot in the Derby. But if it's 110 degrees in the shade, are you really going to want to be pounding on your horse day in and day out to get him ready to go a mile and a quarter? So, could there be another race? You know, yeah, possibly. I would say he'd certainly be nominated to the Ellis race. I believe he's nominated to the Travers, but I don't see that as being an option. Rather than having him on my plan, I'd rather be on his plan and be watching him every day and, you know, let him kind of take us along to where we need to be.
Well, on that topic, where you are and getting this as your first graded stake win, I mean, you've certainly won your share of stakes that didn't have a number next to them. I mean, Tommy, talk about, you know, growing up, going to the racetrack, you know, you and Clocker John, Danny Gargan, you know, there's this whole, Brad Cox is going to be on with us next. You know, there's a whole group of people that, you know, grew up around the racetrack, and, you know, these kinds of moments and opportunities are what you dream about.
It really is. And gosh, I remember, you know, everybody that you just mentioned, I remember all of us being kids, you know, running around the backside of Churchill Downs, and we might go in on the weekend, and you know, you might catch a couple stalls and make a little weekend spending money, or, you know, for me, I might gallop a horse or two, or, you know, whatever it might be. It's all any of us have ever wanted to do. So, obviously, you know, Brad and, you know, Dale Romans and, you know, watching them, Dale's just a few years older than I am. And, watching them do what they've done, you know, and you know, Danny, gosh, I mean, he, you know, he's, you know, he's just killing it in New York now. It's a lot of fun, and you know, there's a lot of good memories that we've all had back there, and you know, to be able to finally feel like, you know, I'm kind of starting to fall into that category of being a graded stakes winning trainer, and you know, to win a race like the Bluegrass, you know, it's pretty special. You just can't help but you know, you can't help but think about where you came from and what you had to go through to get here.
And talk about what you did go through to get here. You know, you if we're going to talk family, you know, your father, you know, got on horses for Blackie Huffman, and you know, all of those intertwined you know, names and generations are involved in this. You know, you've trained now for an extended period for Claiborne as well. I mean, the respect that you command is clear. It's you know, it's hard though to you know, make that move, you know, from I don't want to say, I guess we could use the journeyman, you know, the way jocks are referred to as journeymen. You know, there's a class of trainer out there that, you know, wins at a nice clip, and you know, everybody knows, you know, can do well with a horse, whether they claim one or pick one out. But it is hard sometimes to break into that next level and make people realize, oh, I could send an elite prospect his way.
Yeah, it, you know, I remember I got my trainer's license when I was 18, and you know, just from then until my late 20s, I just had a few horses at one time. I know there were several years that I went there and didn't win a race, so. You know, once I got out to Odom County to the training center, I kind of found my niche out here. I was able to get my foot in the door with Bill Mott, and you know, I'd galloped horses for him and Frankie Brothers and some of the other guys around Churchill, and I was able to get my foot in the door with them as, you know, just doing some layups and babies and things of that nature, and you know, that kind of led me being able to run a horse or two for them. And you know, that kind of led to them, you know, hey, this horse isn't doing it in my program. You might send it to Tommy and let him, you know, try it at, you know, Old River Downs or Turfway or something like that. And, you know, it's just kind of happened in baby steps, but it's happening. And, you know, to be able to get my foot in the door, you know, especially Claiborne. I mean, you know, Seth and Walker have just been so good to me over the years and given me so many opportunities, and not to mention just the lifeline that is, you know, and being able to have conversations with them about horses and to educate yourself to their thought process and how they not only evaluate horses but what they're looking for. And, you know, I've said it a million times, I feel like I've got a Harvard education in training horses just because of the people that I've been fortunate enough to work for. So I, you know, to finally kind of maybe go beyond that and to get an opportunity in a race like the Bluegrass, it's huge, because it's just not an opportunity that we get on a regular basis. So it's certainly not taken for granted.
How important has Gleishaw been in this whole process?
You know, he's actually been quiet. You know, Indiana basketball, they've been quiet. Gleishaw's been quiet. So, you know, life is good here in Kentucky. So, but, I, Tim was one of the first people to send me a very kind message after that horse won the other day. Of course, I did the same thing when he won his big race up there. And as tough of a time as we give each other, he's a great friend, a good horseman, and I, you know, we're always rooting for him.
Well, he's got a little lead on you in terms of graded stake wins, but you're on the board now.
I'm gaining ground. Absolutely, I'm gaining ground on him.
you can hear Battaglia saying, "Gaining ground is
absolutely
too funny." Well, the outpouring of support and happiness. How many messages did you receive? Like, I'm very curious.
By the time I. by the time I drove home Saturday night, I think I was over 300 text messages, and I think there was, I don't know, I think there was like 180 Facebook messages. So I'm still trying to get back to everyone. You know, just the kind messages and the people that reached out, I mean, it just, it means the world to you. You know everybody's watching a race like that, but until you actually see all the messages and all the well wishes, it really doesn't hit home. But it just, you know, it was just a special day. I remember I finally had a chance to talk to my mother on the way home, and both of us almost ended up being a blubbering mess before it was over with, and it was just a special day from top to bottom.
Well, I heard, I guess it was, let's see, we were driving, where were Tina and I? We were driving somewhere, and I think Clocker John, I think he only just stopped crying himself. He was so happy for you, Tommy. And he appreciated, he wrote something. I don't know if you saw it on, are you on Twitter?
Yeah, I think I am, but I very seldom do I get on there. Yeah.
Well, he wrote something in response to somebody congratulating you, and you know, we talked, you know, we on the show as part of the, you know, the pandemic timing and trying to drive it home for people, you know, that somebody like John, you know, who lost a lung, you know, that John is a guy that, you know, that we all knew and know that, you know, is at risk. And he wrote how you checked in with him repeatedly while he was, you know, sequestered at home, and what it meant to him, and as a demonstration of what kind of a friend you are, I wanted to tell this story because
I was a little worried about him. You know, he went through a lot, and I mean, but you know, we were really worried about him when he went through that, and you know, fortunately, he's passed it. But you know, when he start talking about all the people that this, you know, that this affects and the way that it affects them, you know, I just wanted to make sure grocery shopping and things like that, of course, he was taken care of. I'm sure he had a laundry list of people that were willing to help him out. You know, everybody loves John. I will say I tried, you know, I don't know that I've ever asked John to handicap a race for me, but I know there's nobody any better that you know, he pays such close attention to racing and the horses. And I finally did the week of the race, I finally did call him and said, okay, what do you think? And, you know, and he was very kind. We went through the list, and he told me what he thought. And you know, fortunately, he had us winning the race, and that's exactly how it happened. So it was.
Well, just so pleased, and you know, I made the comment too that it's just good for the sport when a horseman like you wins, gets a horse like this that comes your way, and you show that, you know, if given the opportunity. You know, we all know a lot of the big outfits and the headline outfits. We know what they can do, but it sends a very positive message out there, Tommy. That, you know, give horsemen a chance with potential good horses, and you'll be paid off. And certainly looking forward to what lies ahead.
You know, it's funny. We all, you know, like, especially like, you know, at Belterra and places like that, and I race a lot of my horses there. And believe me when I tell you, there's a lot of really, really good top horsemen at that racetrack. And,
sure.
You know, we all kind of joke. I wonder if some of the big outfits could win, you know, this non-winners a 2 for 5. I mean, because, you know, the cheaper horses, you have to get in their head a little more. And, you know, it's just, you know, the good horses are, they're so different, you know. They withstand the pressures of racing better. They just, everything about them, it seems like it's a little easier. It's the cheaper ones that'll just absolutely make you bang your head against the wall. You know, they need things to go their way. They need the sun in the right spot, the right racing surface, the right trip. And you know, I think there's just, you know, there's so many good horsemen out there that all they need is an opportunity. And you know, if we can do a small part to help some of these guys get noticed, then that's fantastic. That's what it's all about.
Tom Drury, everybody, and art collector for Bruce Lunsford, Brian Hernandez Jr., with a very big Derby horse, and of course, Brian already with a Breeders' Cup Classic to his credit and on his resume. And Tommy, whatever's going to happen, whether there's another prep involved or whether it's straight to the Derby September 5th, keep him healthy, happy, and we'll look forward to seeing you there and talking later over the summer.
Hopefully you and I'll have a phone conversation on that Monday.
Well, let me tell you, that would be, and there's so many people that would just be delighted and tickled for you and Bruce and Brian. We'll just leave it out there and let's not tempt fate and let's get there and put them in the gate.
Yes, sir. That sounds great. Thank you for having me, Steve.
Not at all. Tommy Drury, everybody, an art collector. Really a winning story here that's in the process of being told. We're telling you everything that went on over the weekend, and we'll do more of it tomorrow as well as we get ready for Saratoga. And, of course, there's plenty of racing today, including Indiana and Canterbury back at it, our midweek focuses. So we'll touch on some of that too. And I want to get an update as well. I want to get the update from Lone Star too. You know, they're going to try to get those stakes in Tuesday. So let's find out from Mary. I also, when we come back from this break, we got Brad Cox coming. Terry Meeks can't join us or Johnny Velasquez from the Jockeys Guild, but I do have a couple of statements, a couple of thoughts from Terry that he wants to get communicated to address the scenario that the jocks are facing right now, and they're trying to work through. Let's take a break here. Come back for hour three. Brad Cox joins us next. Talk about his week, which included a sweep of the Indiana Derby and Oaks, as well, of course, as the return performance from Monomoy Girl, and looking toward the personal ensign and the Breeders' Cup distaff. Brad Cox next.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the Races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Developed by Horsemen, Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, environment-friendly, paperless revolution of how equine industries bill and receive payments. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for each horse, whose owners can pay through the same website with just one click. Say goodbye to stacks of invoices, handwritten checks, and postage costs. Easy accounting for all parties with the highest online security measures. Get started free at Horsebills.com. Simply register with your name and email address. Free to sign up. No subscription fees to vendors until the first invoice is sent. For owners, you get a free account, comprehensive dashboard with information on all horses owned and billing records, ACH and credit card payment options. For vendors, generate invoices efficiently and receive payments quickly from both owners and other vendors. Syndicate and partnership managers get flexible billing and payment options to both vendors and syndicate members. For more info, call 888-938-4643, 888-938-4643, or log on to horsebills.com. That's horsebills.com.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sportsform Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sportsform delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit